Back together again, you and I kicking off a brand new month, middle of the week style, Wednesday, March 1st, 2023 on Connecticut Today. We welcome the Stamford Police Association's Officer of the Year, Officer Michael Montanaro. Former Derby Fire Chief Chuck Stanky looked back at the infamous Sponge Rubber Plant fire in downtown Shelton 48 years ago today. And finally, I had some additional thoughts regarding the continued affordable housing debate going on at the Capitol in Hartford. As we are wont to do here on WICC, all of our local programs, we like to honor what is good and right about the men and women in blue, the thin blue line, the men and women who protect us every day with our state police and, importantly, our local police departments as well. And we've worked with the Stamford Police to honor their officers of the year over the past few years, and this year no different. Right here on Connecticut Today, we welcome 9-year veteran officer Michael Montanaro of Stamford, the Stamford Police Association, naming Officer Montanaro as its 2022 Police Officer of the Year. Michael, hi, it's Paul on WICC. How are you?
Good, Paul. How are you?
Good, good. Congratulations. Do you have any idea this was coming, Mike? Were you surprised or what?
Yeah, it's definitely a surprise, and it's a nice, extremely humbling to be voted this award by the past recipients of the award. So it's definitely one of the highest achievements that we can get in this department.
At what point, Michael, in the early years, did you know you wanted to do this, right? At what point did you say, yeah, I think I'll go into training. This sounds like something. When was that?
In terms of just becoming a cop?
Yeah, just becoming a cop. Yeah, entering the field. Yeah.
Earlier on in my life, I think I was always drawn to it. I had a grandfather that passed away when I was really young, and that was kind of the reason why I always looked at police to kind of see what my grandfather, would have been like had I, got to meet him. So that was always like an infatuation with cops to be able to see what they're like and get a picture of what he would have been like. So always drawn to it from a relatively young age.
So you've been on the force 9 years. You're the Officer of the Year. What was it like early on? I mean, I know you guys and gals go through all the training. You go to the academy. You learn as much as you can. But, Mike, I've got to imagine your first few real shifts on the street must be something.
Yeah, it's definitely there's a level of comfort growing up in the city that you now police in because you are – familiar with the area. We definitely, guys that are from the area, have a little bit of an advantage, but when you go to like your first couple calls alone, you're kind of looking around like, hey, when are the police gonna get here?
You are the police and you are the cops.
They're like looking at you to resolve the issue, and you're kind of like, why is everybody looking at me? It's like, I'm supposed to be fixing something here.
Now, again, that's interesting. You bring that up, Michael, and the guest is Officer Michael Montanaro, the 2022 Stamford Police Association Officer of the Year. You know, Michael, on a lot of these TV shows we see on all these channels now and all these podcasts and YouTube and everything, everybody loves to watch the high-speed chase or the situation where, they've got to draw weapons and everything. But you just said something that was interesting. It's like you get there, and it's not always that. Is it they're just looking to you to try and maybe calm somebody down or tell them what's right and what's wrong in the situation? They're looking at the officers, you guys and gals, as somebody to just be on something, calm things down, right?
Yeah, I would say very, very few and far in between do we deal with what people would classify as the exciting, movie set type scenarios. Most of it is just regular day-to-day drama that just people can't work out themselves, or something as simple as a car accident or an alarm call to a residence that the wind caused an alarm to go off. So it's definitely certain areas, I think, within the police department has a little bit more action, some areas a little bit more reserved. But I would say from a general standpoint, if you follow us around on a regular basis, you're not going to you're going to see a lot of paperwork being done, and you're going to see a lot of kind of just time in the cruiser going from call to call.
Honoring the men and women in blue, as we do right here on this program and on all our shows on WICC, the Stanford Police Association 2022 Officer of the Year, Officer Michael Montanaro, is the guest for a little while longer. Michael, you mentioned earlier, yeah, a lot of it's this kind of routine work, going from call to call, fender benders and all that paperwork. But you have involved yourself in some pretty serious stuff that people should know about. You have used your connections in the community to, let me see here, seize illegal firearms, 15 of them last year. You also encountered people, some real dangerous folks who were distributing those firearms and also narcotics as well. Talk a little bit about that. What does that kind of investigation take?
Like I said before, I think going, starting from the community that you grew up in, you obviously have a passion to try to make it better, make it safer for your family and loved ones. When you do start out as a cop, we helped out a lot of the narcotics guys earlier on in our careers, and that's just what I was drawn to in terms of, like, that's where the action is, and that's where I felt using some of the connections within the city, people playing sports and having those relationships, it would best suit the department to go into that area and kind of remove what's not supposed to be in there to make the community grow.
Mm. So I guess you're saying the connections and the relationships you build, Michael, not just for you and the other officers, I guess it's a matter of trust, right? If these kids or these adults trust you, they may say, hey, that case the other night, or there's some bad apples on this street you may want to pay attention to. So I guess it's trying to get over that hump of people not wanting to talk, right?
Yeah, I think, one thing I did realize earlier on is I think most of the population wants the community the same common goal. Whether or not, like, they're going to run up to you when there's a crowd of people out there, they mm-hmm. may not. But, people can read people very well, and they know at the end of the day, we're out here trying to achieve a common goal with the community. And they look at you and realize you're a person that can be trusted and is out here doing the job the correct way. They won't hesitate to call you and give you the information that's ultimately going to get somebody that they don't want in their community out.
A lot of the big city mayors over the past couple of months, Michael, have been pushing more to get the repeat gun offenders off the street, and I'm sure that's something not just you but all the other officers in your department see every day with the scourge of these illegal guns and the ghost guns. And, you know, like you say, it's not a lot of people out there. I've had mayors tell me that, Michael, over the years, but in cities like Stanford, you know, people may not realize that a core of bad apples can really make it tough for the rest of the city.
Yeah, Stanford's been really fortunate. We've been under some great leadership for a relatively long time. We take our fair share of weapons off the street, and our fair share of narcotics, as those two go hand in hand. But I think having them present and having the relationship that we have with the court system next door, Stanford is known as a place that is not very popular with the criminal element because of the job that the men and women do on a daily basis here and have done for a very long time, way before I was fortunate enough to put on the uniform. So
finally, Michael, speaking of that job, I ask this every time I have officers like yourself on for whatever reason. If there's a young man or young woman listening out there who doesn't want to know what they want to do with their life, or if they're considering maybe looking at the police profession, what would you tell them?
The easiest, my advice would be utilize the ride-along program. Like, come out to the, whether it's Stanford or Norwalk or any surrounding town, go and do a ride-along and see what the men and women do on a daily basis, to see if it fits their personality, to see if it fits their way of living. I would not be able to do this job if it wasn't for the support system I have at home. That's where a lot of things obviously start and end with. But if you got to get into the car and you got to be able to see firsthand like what this job is about, and if it's in it for you, as opposed to just blindly taking a test for some town or community you don't have any ties to, that would be my recommendation to them.
Officer Michael Montanaro, the Stanford Police Association 2022 Officer of the Year. Michael, again, congratulations from all of us. Take care, be safe, and we'll chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
Paul, thank you for your time. Have
Thanks, Michael. Appreciate it. Officer Michael Montanaro, Stanford Police Department, the Police Association 2022 Officer of the Year, 9-year veteran. You can hear he's very involved in his home community, and in particular, he's worked aggressively to get illegal guns and narcotics and drugs off of the streets. If you are maybe in your late 50s to early 60s, you may certainly have a recollection of what happened on this day 48 years ago, March 1st, 1975. And for many people who lived or still live in the Valley, particularly in Shelton, the words, the sponge rubber fire, still bring back horrible memories. A 3-block-long factory for sponge rubber products in Shelton was incinerated by an incendiary device with an investigation to follow, and it was certainly an all-hands-on-deck scenario back then. Made not only, of course, local news, state news, and made national and world news. Well, the gentleman who was obviously around back then and who has memories of that joins us today to talk about that 48 years ago today. Former Derby Fire Chief Chuck Stanky is with us. Chuck, welcome back to the show. How are you, sir?
I'm fine. How about you, Paul?
I'm good, Chuck. Thanks for taking time out. Boy, it's almost 50 years, Chuck. Now, I was 14 back then. And then when I heard this news and the ensuing coverage of it, Chuck, in the following days, all I could sit there watching TV was, oh, my God, look at this. Take us back, Chuck, in your remembrances to that day, March 1st and 1975.
I can remember it just like it was yesterday. It's unbelievable. I'm from the Derby Fire Department, and we normally responded with them as mutual aid. As you know, all the firemen in the Valley are 100% volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
So it was our normal response area to go there. We drill there and everything. And on that evening, we actually had a banquet at one of our firehouses. And we were there at the banquet, and somewhere around 11:30, we heard this God-wrenching explosion. Nobody
wow.
knew what it was. I mean, and that was across the river. We could actually hear it and feel it in Derby. And I remember, you know, people saying that all of a sudden the call started coming in, and you could look out and look across, and all you saw was fire from one end of the building to the other. It was unbelievable. In fact, it's one of the biggest fires that I can remember in my 48 years of serving in the fire department, and I've been to some pretty big fires, but that's still number one in my book.
Now, Chuck, did you drill? Did you guys back then, guys and gals, 48 years ago, you said you trained there, so did you prepare, did all the Valley units prepare for something like that, Chuck? Like, hey, what do we do if, for whatever reason, part of this factory or this whole place goes up vis-a-vis what was inside with chemicals and everything?
Not to the extent that it was, but we did train and drill. Of course, back then we didn't have the the modern day equipment that we have now. But like I said, we were mutual aid. We would never expect it to be as big. It covered the whole building.
Yeah.
I mean, from block to block, and it was there. But we had trained, and it brought in over 700 firefighters from throughout the state. Usually, you know, you get a big fire, you get somebody from New Haven County, Fairfield County, but we had firemen from all throughout the state coming, both career and volunteer. And it sits right at the bottom of Route 8. In fact, the state police
mm-hmm.
literally shut down Route 8 right there, that nobody was allowed to go Route 8. And, everybody worked together. we were there. One good thing that I actually remember was the Shelton, the Echo Hose, had a 1939 Aaron's Fox fire truck that they had decommissioned in the 70s. And they put that back into service for that fire. They brought it down, and it actually pumped out of the canal and fed a great deal of fire apparatus to put water on that fire. That's how big it was.
Wow. Yeah, everybody in Seymour, Shelton, Derby, and Sonia, the whole state, the whole country, the whole world, we're talking about a huge fire that took place 48 years ago today, March 1st, 1975. And I was old enough to remember the sponge rubber plant fire in Shelton, and Chuck Stanky is with us. Chuck was among the folks who responded to that. Chuck, the former Derby fire chief. So, Chuck, you get on the scene. I mean, I would think at that point it was containment, right, that it didn't spread because, I mean, you tell me there was no point in even trying to save the building, right?
Oh, you're absolutely correct. When we came, we come from across the bridge. And the factory actually sat on Canal Street, and you could not get on Canal Street because, number one, it was so hot, and it was debris all over the roads. Most of the firefighting originally started from Howe Avenue, which is the next street up. And, again, we didn't have modern-day equipment like we have today, so it was a lot of lug and hose and manpower intensive. And, in fact, the back of the building you couldn't even get at. It was melting the metal and the beams and everything else. The fire started and actually didn't get under control till like the next day, but it actually burned for almost a week and a half. We could say it was completely out, and just it burned metal and everything. One of our chief at the time, Joe Iacone, he happened to work there as a plant manager, so he knew, you know, the building and everything, and it put a lot of people out of work, almost 900 people out of work, and the valley was in, you know, an industrial giant that time, so it put 900 people out of work.
The heat, Chuck, must have been, like you said, you couldn't get near the building. The heat, the heat thrown from that thing must have been incredible.
Not only the heat, but the debris that was blown out. There was glass up on Howe Avenue and all over. It actually broke the windows. The explosion and the force of the explosion broke the windows in the Echo Firehouse, which is like four blocks away.
Wow.
And it was there because, you know, they actually, the cause of the fire they found was they brought in 50 gallon drums of gasoline, wired it with deck cord and dynamite, and blew it up.
Now, it was an insurance policy scam here worth $60 million, I see. Now, the owner, Charles Moeller, who passed away, Chuck, he was 85 in the year 2013. So he was acquitted, right? But I guess he never collected on that policy is what they said.
That is correct. The FBI investigation, he got acquitted, but there was eight others that were involved in the whole plan and the scheme. And although he got acquitted, it was still an arson, so not a penny of insurance money was paid out.
It's amazing, Chuck, and obviously over your years, you may have responded to several fires that maybe in the end have turned out to be said or some degree of arson. But it's sad and crazy, Chuck, that some people still think, oh, I'll get away with it because they'll never figure it out. But, you know, you folks in the fire department and the amazing fire signs that especially exist today, I mean, it's hard to get away with that today, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And you have to realize the investigation that took place at this sponge rubber was 48 years ago. We didn't have the technology that we have today with, you know, different chemicals and stuff. So it was actually getting in there and digging through and finding the trail. The Connecticut State Police Fire Investigation Unit was on the scene with the FBI there. And they actually literally dug through all the debris and stuff and found trail marks on the floors and got it down to the deck cord and stuff. So very labor-intensive. It was a massive investigation that went across the country. I mean, they interviewed people in Pennsylvania, New York, and all over.
Obviously, Chuck, I would assume, but maybe not, let me ask you, that obviously had to be the worst thing you ever responded to, right?
Yeah, it was pretty big. The only, if you want to say, sunshine in the cloud was when they blew it up. There was three people working, and they took those three people out, they actually kidnapped them. They got arrested for kidnapping.
I saw that, yeah.
There were two security people and a boiler operator, and they took them away. So nobody got killed or injured, you know, in the fire itself, which was amazing, a fire of that magnitude.
48 years ago tonight on March 1st, 1975, like I said, if you're maybe in your mid to late 50s or at least early 60s, you remember the massive sponge rubber fire, the sponge rubber factory in Shelton. Former Derby Fire Chief Chuck Stanky was among the 700-plus personnel that responded to that blaze. Chuck, good to have you back again. Thank you, sir. We'll talk down the road. Be good.
All right. Thank you. Stay safe.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Chuck. How about that? You remember that, folks? Any recollections of that? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. So that was 1975, 48 years ago tonight. So I'm guessing if you're maybe late 50s, 58, 59, 60, into early to mid-60s, what are your recollections of that? Chuck said that they were at a dinner across the river, and they could feel the they could feel the actual concussion of the explosion. And I remember, of course, I didn't grow up in that area. I grew up in New Haven, but you know, I was 14 years old, and I remember it's a lingering hearing the news on radio and then seeing the, you know, the TV coverage primarily at that point in my my existence from Channel 3 and Channel 8. There, any recollections of that? If you're a Valley person, the sponge rubber fire 48 years ago tonight. And we still try and figure out after another day in the General Assembly, and I know they're trying, I know they honestly really are, but we're still trying to figure out what in heck to do about the housing in Connecticut or lack thereof or lack of available housing. And we've talked about this over the last few days because it's a major topic, and there was testimony at the state capitol yesterday about all this stuff, which... And again, I understand it. I'm on board with trying to find a solution. But again, I don't know what the solution is. I didn't know what it is, what it was, or what it is yesterday. And sorry to tell you, I still don't know what it is today. Because there are... we're doing what we usually do in Connecticut, is we look at things, and forgive me if I sound like a cracked record here, but we look at things from, you know, for example, the wrong angle here. And it doesn't mean that there aren't, you know, numerous people up at the General Assembly who are well-meaning and really recognize the problems that we have here. I mean, I get that. I understand that. But again, I'm reading today. I'm saying, well, what came out of all that testimony yesterday and all these housing bills that are threatening to do this, that, or the other? And I don't know. There are all these bills being chatted about out up there, and I guess conversation, you know, on any angle is good, no matter what the issue might be. But again, we know what the issue is here. The issue is there's not a lot of affordable housing in this state. We know that. We've been talking about that for years and years and years. Connecticut's a really expensive place to live in. And if anything, you know, you may think I'm wrong about this. I think I'm not. The costs have been going up for years, and sort of those areas that were once, I guess, concentrated, you know what I mean? Concentrated smaller areas that were kind of these exclusive areas, you know, where one could live if you were a certain economic strata or a certain income. I'm guessing here that the situation is not getting any better. And those areas that were once these really tight inclusive enclaves, they're probably getting wider here. So let's take a look at this. I wanted to start the show this way, and you chime in here whether you think these are good ideas, bad ideas, or are we still just beating around the bush? Because maybe we just have to, and it doesn't mean you stop doing what you want to do. If you're an advocate for more affordable housing, if you want more affordable and diverse housing in your locality, your neighborhood, your town, your city, but can any of this really work? Couple of big bills aimed at addressing issues were debated up in Hartford yesterday. So what are they actually talking about? And we have a lot of people on this show and on Lisa's show and on Melissa's show in the morning. And, you know, it can't, you know, your eyes can kind of glaze over here if you don't really get or understand what's going on here. So, you know, again, let me just tell you, in other words, on the surface, we know what the problem is. Too little housing, too little affordable housing, and a lot of people who want affordable housing and want to live and spread their roots out in Connecticut. Okay, I guess we can all agree on that, I guess. So here's one. Let me lead you by the hand up to the Capitol yesterday. They talked about, how about this, if you're scoring at home, kids, this is House Bill number 6781. So break out your little, hold on, get your little House scorecard here, 6781. Now, what's in House Bill 6781 that we had all these hearings and testimony about yesterday? I'm not saying any of this is bad. But understand here, ask yourself, does any of this solve the problem? And I'm not besmirching anyone who looks to introduce bills or legislation or ideas that in the end can work better. That's not what I'm about here. But let me just tell you what they actually did talk about. House Bill 6781 has reforms in it to ensure housing is safe and sanitary, including up to $2,000 per violation and penalties for violations of municipal codes and a requirement that landlords offer tenants the opportunity to walk through a unit and note any damages before leases begin. Well, aren't you supposed to do that? Isn't that, you know what I mean here? Aren't you supposed to, like, who doesn't rent a place without a walkthrough? All right, so that's a laudable thing, but does that solve any problems? I'm just kind of asking here. This bill also has changes to tenant screening, including a requirement that the screening fees for tenants cannot exceed the actual cost landlords pay for the report, and a requirement that landlords cannot consider eviction records that are more than 5 years old. Okay. Kind of sounds like it ties the landlord's hand, but I'm okay with that. And then it also says, one aspect here is that it requires municipalities to develop fair housing plans by January 1st of the coming year. Okay, so we're going to have another plan. The next part of this bill, and I'm not saying any of this is bad. Please don't misunderstand me here. But it sounds like we're in a mode here when we just kind of propose stuff that doesn't really get at the core problem. Because the core problem is hard. It proposes changes to the real estate conveyance tax for certain investors. The intention is to increase the amount of taxes paid by large investors who buy up lots of single-family housing and to invest those profits in affordable housing. Okay, sounds good. Where are you investing it? More bond funding to increase affordable housing and address other housing-related issues. Okay, again, sounds really good. You're gonna bond out again? Gee, we never do that in Connecticut. Hey, let's bond out more stuff that we have to pay for. Well, where are you paying for the stuff? And again, let me say again and again, I'm not in any way chiding people for suggesting this stuff. But it seems to me that it's stuff just for the sake of being stuff. And I know people say, well, this is part of a multi-pronged plan. When do the multi-pronged plans ever work in the state? Have we not had multi-pronged plans for lowering taxes, for cheaper energy? Has that ever worked? Have we not had multifaceted plans to attract more businesses here, to make it cheaper to operate? So that was in the House bill. Now, here's the Senate bill. A ban on most wintertime evictions and limits on late charges for rent. Okay. There's nothing wrong with that. You shouldn't be tossing people on the street if you can all afford it in the middle of a cold winter. I understand that. When I see, you know, people fall prey to that, I say to myself, you know, I mean, man, oh, man, but for the grace of God, go me. You know, landlords didn't like that bill, saying it represented government interference in private contracts, which it is. And they needed measures to be able to get people who are not paying rent out of the property. Tenants groups liked it, of course not. Okay. Support for workforce housing. The governor said he supports more workforce housing with financial support measures. This bill would add to that with tax credits for a workforce housing opportunity development program and would allow municipalities to exempt workforce housing from property taxes. Okay, number one, what's workforce housing? How's that defined? And where are you going to build it? Do you build it in the cities? And again, the reason I kind of bring this up, I you may think I'm nitpicking here. The reason I bring this stuff up is we always look at this from a macro point of view. Oh, look at this. We need more housing. That's fine. The specific, the answer to all this is getting more housing units in cities and towns that people can afford. But what do you do if those cities and towns, for whatever reason, be they genuine or not, what do you do if they don't want it? Maybe they just don't want it. And maybe, I hate to be a jerk about this, but all things being equal, all things being considered on most sides, maybe it's something you have to live with. I don't know. Grants to encourage environmentally friendly housing upgrades with a focus on environmental justice. Okay. A pilot program to provide temporary housing for folks who are experiencing homelessness and veterans who need respite care. That goes beyond even suggestion. That's what you got to do. There's also talk, again, of a rent cap. This Senate bill originally included a measure that would cap annual rent increases at 4% plus the consumer price index. It was amended, though, Monday afternoon, that excluded that portion. So there was going to be a 4% cap, then there wasn't going to be a 4% cap, and then it was going to be tied to the consumer price index. Again, what does this have to do with creating more affordable housing? What does this have to do with putting up a foundation, a driveway, four walls or more, and a roof on whatever property? And then we had talks about zoning here yesterday, which a lot of people consider should be a strictly local issue. So, I don't doubt that a lot of our wonderful lawmakers on both sides of the issue are very benevolent about this. They're genuine in their enthusiasm of solving this problem. But I don't see it being solved. I'm sorry, maybe not in the short term.